Hello, everybody. Welcome to my home here in the Pacific Northwest. It's a pleasure for me to have this opportunity to join with you. And it seems to me it's particularly ironic and significant that we come together to explore the ideas of Gaia and Gaianeering on the day that the United States has withdrawn from the Paris Climate Accords. So I imagine that many of you may be feeling some distress over this. And if so, I hope that our talk together today will be of help. So there's different ways that we can approach this topic. And what I would like to do is to begin with a bit of background and overview, and then focus more on what we can do as individuals to be part of Gaia, to take advantage of this time for Gaia, and to become, in our own individual and unique ways, Gaianeers. The first thing we want to do is to consider just what we mean by Gaia. It's one of those ideas where it's easy to assume that we understand what lies behind that word. It's a word that rolls easily off the tongue, and certainly it has mythic connotations, being the name of the Greek goddess of the earth. And we can think, well, this means that the earth is a living being, a great planetary soul, but exactly what does that mean? So I'd like to begin by talking about what I think of as the four faces of Gaia, the four ways that Gaia may be defined. Back in the 70s, the British scientist Lovelock published his book, Gaia, A New Way of Seeing the Earth, A New Look at Life. And in that book, Lovelock, who was an engineer, postulated that the biosphere acted in ways that replicated what living organisms did, particularly in terms of self-regulation. Now, Lovelock had been invited by NASA to develop a technological means of determining if there were life on Mars. In so doing, just as an experiment, he thought he would use his approach to see if there were life on Earth. A certain wry British humor there. But to his surprise, what he came up with was the data that suggested that the Earth itself, taken as a whole, acted as if it were a living being. And so then he, and later Dr. Lynn Margulis, who was a prominent microbiologist, put their heads together, metaphorically speaking, and came up with the Gaia hypothesis. And basically, this hypothesis said that the biosphere of the planet was self-regulating and acted in ways to maintain a balance that was conducive to life. And in this way, it acted as if it were a single great organism. And Lovelock, in a fit of poetic whimsy, called this organism, Gaia, after the Greek goddess of the earth. And much to his surprise, the scientific community did not immediately accept the validity of his data or of his hypothesis, but the spiritual and environmental communities did. And the idea of Gaia as a living organism, the earth as a living organism, took off. Given that this was the 70s and the 80s and the New Age movement was in full swing and environmental movements were in full swing, this should not have been a huge surprise, particularly since the idea of the earth as a living organism was one that our ancestors held and cherished. So it was not as if Lovelock had discovered something that no one had ever thought of before. He actually touched a very deep racial memory. And in the process, the Gaia hypothesis became widely accepted and affirmed, but not by the scientific community as he had hoped. Now, that confirmation came later. And indeed, as the evidence came in to support the hypothesis, it graduated from being a hypothesis to a theory. So now it is officially known as the Gaia theory. Lovelock and Margulis were both members of the Lindisfarne Association, as was I. And the fellows of that association would gather once a year in a conference to talk and to share their research and work, and generally just to cross-fertilize, because the members of the association came from a great many disciplines, economics, politics, science, art, spirituality, and so forth. And here was an opportunity for people who normally would not have a chance to talk together to do so. So one afternoon, Lovelock and Margulis and I were walking down by the beach near where the conference was being held. And I had the privilege of listening in while Lovelock and Margulis debated the Gaia hypothesis. And at the end of the conversation, as we reached a particular fork in the road and Dr. Margulis decided she was going to head back to the conference center, she said to Lovelock, "You know, you should not have included that last chapter in your book in which you said that the earth was a living being." And then she walked off, and it was obvious that this was a discussion that they had had many times before, a kind of amicable disagreement. And as she strode off into the distance, Lovelock turned to me and he said, "Well, it was my book and I could write what I wanted." So it was interesting that even he felt this pull of the mythic power of the idea of Gaia. So that's the first face of Gaia, this idea that the biosphere of the earth, the whole system of weather, atmosphere, all the living creatures, all the ecosystems, the oceans, and so on, all interact and work together through self-regulating processes to maintain a balance that is hospitable to life. Now, the second face of Gaia is the one that the non-scientists, the spiritual people, the mythologists, the poets, just about everybody else took as being the meaning of the hypothesis, a sense that there was behind the physical manifestations of the biosphere a true spiritual life, a great being, a subtle being, a being that was intelligent and was at the heart of life on earth, a true goddess, if you wish. So the second face, and it's the one with which I am most familiar, is that of Gaia as a subtle presence, a non-physical being, a planetary angel, if you wish. And I'll come back in a moment and say some more about just what such a being may be. But for the moment, I just want to identify this as the second face. It's this definition of Gaia, really, that our ancestors held. By whatever name they may have called this being, it was the sacred life within the earth, the presence that overlighted all living entities upon this planet, the soul of the world. The third face of Gaia is, I guess you would say, its cognitive face. That is, Gaia as a way of thinking and a way of perceiving and appreciating the world. As the idea of Gaia spread, I found that it would come up in classes and lectures that I was giving back in the 80s and 90s. And obviously, attention was being paid to the idea of this great planetary being, and people wanted to know more about who or what Gaia might be. But this really wasn't the most important piece of what Gaia represented. What was even more important was to understand the function of Gaia. That is, what exactly was it that Gaia did? And how was its life manifested? And even more importantly, how could we participate in that life? How could that life manifest through us? And so I came up with a question that I would ask in my classes, which is, what does it mean to think like a planet? If I were Gaia, or if you were Gaia, what would you be like? Who would you be like? How would your thought processes be different from the way they are now? Now, of course, there's no real way of answering that question. But what I wanted people to come to was a realization that this idea of Gaia also represented a particular way of looking at the world, a way that saw in terms of systems and patterns, in terms of interconnections, in terms of wholenesses. Because if there is one feature that stands out in the environment and that is highlighted by the Gaia hypothesis, it is the interconnectedness of everything and the ways in which what happens in one part of the world or to one part of the biosphere affects everything else. This is an ecological point of view, and it's one that we have been slowly recapturing in our Western society. It's a very different way of thinking about the world than what has been taken as normal ever since the Enlightenment and the Age of Reason. Here in the West particularly, we have developed an analytical form of consciousness that understands the world by pulling it apart. We seek to understand nature and ourselves by disassembling and looking at the smallest elements that make up our constitution, that make up the nature of life. But from Gaia's point of view, we're not a collection. Life is not a collection. The biosphere is not a collection of small individual parts. Rather, it's a seamless and complete organic whole in which everything affects everything else. When we see the world only as discrete and separate particles, then we develop an attitude that says we can affect this particular set of particles with impunity, because whatever we do in this local area to these local entities will not affect the wider environment. It will stop within that particular and local manifestation. And we've been learning over the past many decades, often to our chagrin and certainly to our discomfort and at times our suffering, that this approach has unforeseen consequences, that actions taken here in A have effects over here in B. And so we have to begin considering the world as this interconnected whole, and that we cannot act as if all the parts that we see were truly separate and discrete and not connected. So that particular way of seeing things, to see in terms of wholenesses, to see in terms of interconnections, to see in terms of networks and patterns, that's the Gaian way of knowing. And it's the third face of Gaia. So we have Gaia as planetary organism, Gaia as a subtle being and planetary intelligence, and Gaia as a way of knowing, a way of thinking and experiencing our world. The fourth way, the fourth definition of Gaia, is one that, from my point of view, is just emerging. And it's one that is at the edge of our understanding. I might call this Homo Gaian, because it's the Gaian part of humanity. It's who we are as human beings, but also as part of this planetary life. In what way does Gaia live in us, not as a planetary entity, not simply as a way of knowing, certainly not just as interconnections within the biosphere, but as a profound aspect of our own humanity? In what way is a human being, a Gaian being, truly a citizen of the planet, and from a subtle point of view, an embodiment of the life of the planet? it's this Gaian human, I feel, that is seeking to emerge. And its emergence will, of course, take place over time. But I believe in our time, we are seeing the seeds of that emergence, and that it's possible for individuals to begin experiencing a Gaian consciousness, an internal transformation of one's own energy field and way of being, in which the individual becomes an expression, a fractal of the Gaian whole. These four aspects of Gaia, the planetary organism, the subtle being, the way of knowing, and the Gaian individual, Homo Gaian, are these four faces of Gaia. And from my point of view, Gaianeering, a wonderful term that was coined by my Laurian colleague, Jeremy Berg, represents the art of bringing these four together. I'll come back to that in just a moment. But I said I wanted to talk some more about just who and what Gaia as a subtle being may be. Now, I'm going to assume that I don't have to, with this audience, explain or justify the existence and nature of the subtle realms, the non-physical dimension of the earth. If you're here listening to me, then it's probably because you expect me to talk about this particular subject matter because of my reputation as somebody who works with subtle beings and with the subtle dimensions. From my point of view, the subtle world is Earth's second ecology. I've been aware of subtle dimensions all of my life. And because of this awareness, and because it started so early for me, the existence of the non-physical side of the earth, its energetic side, its subtle side, just seemed ordinary to me. It was normal. It was not something extraordinary, and certainly not something either religious or mystical or transcendental. In my experiences, the subtle world and the physical world were in constant interaction, and in fact, were part of a larger planetary ecology that encompassed both physical and non-physical dimensions. Because of this particular way of thinking about this, subtle beings have always seemed to me to be the non-physical equivalent, for the most part, of the physical beings, the plants and animals, and of course the people that we see around us daily in our ordinary physical lives. An ecology is the study of the relationship and interconnections between organisms and their environment. If I see the subtle worlds as another kind of environment, then a subtle ecology is exactly the same. It's a way of looking at the interactions and relationships and interconnections between non-physical beings and the particular environments in which they dwell and with which they interact. A part of our challenge is that the English language, for all its versatility, doesn't really give us good words for describing the nature of the subtle dimensions. I know they've often been characterized as dimensions of thought and of a higher frequency of matter, but that really doesn't tell us very much. What kind of thought? What kind of matter? What do we mean by higher frequencies, and so on? And I can't begin to explain all of that here today, nor do I understand all of that. So let me be clear. I'm definitely still researching all this and exploring this second ecology myself. But the point I want to make is that for subtle beings, their world, their environment, is every bit as solid and real to them as ours is to us. And in fact, various subtle colleagues of mine have often commented on the fact that I, as a physical being, and indeed the physical world in general, seems very wispy and dreamlike to them, and not possessing solidity. So I suppose it's tit for tat. We see each other in very different ways. The subtle worlds are not simply a physical world existing in a different dimension. They are truly different places. That is, their constitution, their structure, their physics, their chemistry is not the same as we experience. But the principles of interaction and interconnection, of law and regulation that we find in our biology, in our physics, in our chemistry, are all replicated in their own way in these subtle worlds. What makes it a little hard to describe is that is an issue of scale. Let me give you an example. Here I am. I'm sitting in this room, and off in that direction is the family television set. If I were to turn that on, I could watch the news on ABC television. I could watch a streaming movie on Netflix. I could watch a sitcom on CBS. There's these different stations that I could attune to. When I turn on the television and I say I want to watch the 6 o'clock news on ABC, where is that coming from? Where are the sitcoms that are on CBS? Where are the streaming videos that are on Netflix or on the Amazon channel? They're all around me. They're different frequencies of electromagnetic information, but they're everywhere around me. And in fact, given the ubiquity of modern broadcasting, the dimension, if I may call it that, of the American Broadcasting Corporation, of ABC, or of the BBC, or of Canadian broadcasting, or any of these broadcast shows, is very widespread. So I can call up a friend in Boston, on the other side of the continent, and say, turn on ABC and watch this show. And that friend will be able to do that because we both have access to that same dimension, the ABC dimension. So it's permeating the electromagnetic environment. And given the right receptors, it becomes visible and evident in a way that I can interact with it. Gaia is much the same. Gaia is a life, an intelligence that permeates as a frequency the world. There's no part of the world that you can go to that Gaia is not there. There are places beyond the world that you can go to where our spaceships are going, where you will not find Gaia. But any place upon the earth, Gaia is there, and given the right modes of reception, the right TV station, if you wish, or TV set, I can tune in to this being. The thing of it is that as a what I call a planetary being, it actually is manifesting through multiple frequencies simultaneously. So the Gaia to which I attune may not be the only representation or manifestation of this life. Someone else may attune to a different Gaia. This is a crude example, but if I turn on the news on ABC at 6 o'clock here in the West, and I'm watching the news and I get in touch with my friend in Boston and say, turn on ABC, what my friend will receive is not the 6 o'clock news, but whatever program is being broadcast at 9 p.m., for there's this 3-hour difference between us. So we're both tuning into ABC, but we're seeing two very different things because we're in these different time zones. Gaia's a bit like that. What I'm able to tune into and perceive as this living presence depends a great deal on the state of my own receptive instrument, the state of my consciousness, the state of my energy field, the state of me as an incarnate person, and the quality of energy that vibrates around me. This can be changed through intention, through discipline, through focus, through meditation, and so on. But there's still a kind of default pattern that each of us has that puts us in touch with some aspect of Gaia, and it's not necessarily the same for everyone. This, you may feel that what I'm describing is a system that could lead to confusion, but in fact, what this means is that Gaia has the capacity, and this is really one of the definitions of what it is as a subtle being. It has the capacity to resonate and to touch each individual, each life, whether it's a beetle, whether it's a flatworm, whether it's a bacterium, whether it's a human being, whether it's a maple tree, whatever it may be, it can touch each life according to its capacity to receive and participate in the flow of Gaian energy. It means that all things being equal, this vast presence scales itself to the requirements and to the possibilities of each living organism that is part of its field of life. Now, one thing to understand here is that Gaia is not the origin of life. Gaia really is not equivalent to or the same as the sacred. So it's not a transpersonal entity in that regard. It's not transcendent. It's just vast and complex. But it does have the capacity, and this is one of its primary characteristics, that certainly as far as we are concerned, to nurture and foster and enable the manifestation and development of living consciousness and, of course, physical life upon the earth. So think of Gaia as a kind of multiplier, as a kind of enabler, that the life that comes to us, the basic sacred core of being that comes to us, that comes to all beings out of that generative mystery that is the sacred, is held and nourished and interconnected and, you know, woven together by this vast planetary intelligence that we're calling Gaia. So one of the ways to define the third face of Gaia, that is Gaia as a way of thinking, really isn't to do with thinking in the sense of thinking about the world in holistic ways. It has to do with how we relate in a heart way to fostering and supporting and nourishing the life and the unfoldment of life of the beings who are around us. How, in what way are we a contributor within our own energy field to the promotion of well-being and the flow of life and life energies? So it's not just thinking like a planet, it's nurturing like a planet. That is that third face of Gaia. And if we become serious about this and we begin looking at how my whole beingness, my life, can become a generative focal point for this nurturing and life-fostering presence and energy, how I can be Gaia-like in my relationships to my world, then I am nourishing the seeds of the emergence of Homo Gaian. In the Gaianeering conference that's coming up in 2 months, at the end of July, there will be an opportunity to explore the ins and outs of this Gaianeering process, this being Gaia process, in more depth and fullness than I certainly can do in a 1 hour talk here. So I invite and encourage you, of course, to come and participate or in some way link into what we'll be doing. But beyond that, if I were to give a brief definition or a brief look at how we may participate in Gaianeering, how we become Gaianeers in Jeremy's felicitous phrase, then I would use the four P's. So I participate in the biosphere. This is what most of the environmental movement is about. It's why there's such distress at the moment over the president's decision to withdraw from the Paris Accords. What we've been learning, and probably not learning fast enough over the past few decades, is the impact that human activity is having on the biosphere. And climate change is a shorthand way of talking about that. And I'm not going to go into all that because there's so much written and broadcast and available for you to explore about this side of Gaia. And I am quite sure that as a result of today's activities, we're going to be getting even more and more information about it. But think of it as the question, how do we participate in a way that supports the integrity and coherency and wholeness of the biosphere and does not overwhelm its self-regulatory processes in a way that takes us beyond what they can support or from which they can recover. With the second face of Gaia, with Gaia as a subtle being, a vast, complex planetary intelligence, the second P is that of partnership, rather. We partner with this presence. How can I, in my energetic life, in my subtle life, in the quality of thought and feeling that I emanate as a generative source of subtle impulses, how can I add to the flow of life, to the flow of energies that foster life, that bless life, that bring empowerment and love and nurturing into the subtle environment that surrounds us all, into the fields of life that surround us all? I have here my glass of water. And from the perspective that says this is just a separate, discrete item, an artifact, this glass doesn't care whether I love it or not. It's from the standpoint of Western science, it's not alive. But from the standpoint of Gaia, it is alive. It's not biological life. It's not organic life. It's not the same life my maple tree has. But it's an energetic life. Within this glass, within the substance that makes up this glass, is life, is the flow of energy, of a kind of very basic sentiency. And the challenge, the task, the assignment, if you wish, of Gaia is to nourish the development and evolution of this energetic life. When I partner with Gaia, that can mean something as simple as saying, when I regard this glass and I pick it up, I will do so with love in my fingers, with honor and respect in my fingers for what is here, or for what is here in this little heart, or what is here in my spare pair of eyeglasses. There's nothing in my world that I cannot partner with Gaia to put love into, to put my own heart energy, present energy into, to foster its well-being, to give it blessing. And indeed, this is the most fundamental definition of the act of blessing. So the second P is to partner with the life of Gaia. The third is a perception. If I think of how Gaia thinks and feels, can I see my world the way Gaia sees it? In other words, looking at this glass as if it is alive, seeing the, I don't have to be psychic, I'm not clairvoyant, I'm just acknowledging that there's a presence here. In fact, the more that I begin to acknowledge it, and the more I begin to perceive and to understand my world in this way, the more sensitive I become to experiencing the living energy fields that are within and around things. So how can I think like a planet, which in the simplest form for us as incarnate human beings could simply be, how can I be a loving presence to the life around me, to the people around me, to the plants around me, to the animals around me, to the things around me? And the more that I do that, the more I begin to transform my sense of my own presence, of who and what I am. And I may begin to develop for me an experience of myself, not simply as a human being, but as a Gaian being, Homo Gaian. That's the fourth P, presence. The presence within each of us of a way of being in a loving wholeness with our world. So now I want to say something about working with subtle beings and particularly with Gaia. One of the primary modes of connection is through resonance. What does that mean? When I used to sing in a choir, the choir master sitting at his piano would hit the note that he wanted us to start the song with. And if the different parts of the choir, the sopranos, the altos, the bass, the tenors, if we all started on different notes, he would hit the piano key to give each of us our note. And then we would hear that and we would quietly to ourselves hum that note. Whatever it happened to be. And we would get into the feeling in our body of that note. So that when we began singing, we would be on key. We would be all starting on our proper starting note. We would come into resonance with the note that he had played on the piano or had blown on his pitch pipe. Resonance is that state where two or more beings start to vibrate together in a harmonious fashion, so that there is a communion between them. It's been my experience over the years that most of the subtle beings I encounter do not communicate in anything like language. Certainly not English or any other human language. They don't use words. They don't form sentences. but they communicate through a transmission of meaning, a transmission of beingness, a transmission of energy, I suppose you could say. And this is made possible by our coming into resonance together, so that they vibrate this note, metaphorically speaking, I will vibrate that same note. And when that happens in my energy field, meaning erupts. And then my brain can register that and turn it into images, turn it into impressions, turn it into language, which I can then share with others. But the fundamental relationship is one of resonance. And I've come to experience that as a kind of lingua franca, a universal language in the subtle realms. So in working with Gaia, we're asking how do we come into resonance with this presence? And I've talked a little bit about that through love, through our ability to honestly appreciate and honor and bless and foster and nourish life and so on, to be in ourselves the Gaian note, to hear that note struck and to find its correspondence within us. What's important about this is we're at a time when humanity is genuinely struggling to give birth to a Gaian awareness. And I know, looking at the news and hearing what's happening in the world, it doesn't always seem like that, but many of the struggles that we're experiencing quite beyond the area of environment and ecology, but just in how we relate with each other, are symptomatic of this deeper struggle to begin to experience ourselves first as a planetary species and then as a Gaian species. When we come to that point, and I am optimistically convinced we will, though I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime, we will have come to it in a hard-won way. We will have gone through the fire, so to speak, of really deeply understanding what it means to embody all the contradictions of life and out of that to create a wholeness. But at the moment, we're still struggling with the contradictions and with the conflicts. And one of these conflicts is that between humanity and nature, the environment. And it's that particular conflict that is being highlighted today by the president's decision to withdraw from the climate accords. So I guarantee you that over the next few days and weeks, there is going to be an outcry of disgust, of fear, of anger, of pain, of grief. Because it will seem to us that we are turning our backs, that our country is turning its back on Gaia. It's turning its back on what is needed at each of those four levels of Gaia to create wholeness. But here's where it gets tricky, because the more I fill my energy field with distress, the harder it is to come into resonance with Gaia. And here's an interesting and fine line that we are being asked to walk, particularly, I think, for the next few days and weeks and months, as all this sorts itself out. The fine line is to have a keen and clear sense of discernment of the paths we need to take to honor Gaia in the world and the Gaia within us and the Gaia within each other. And to recognize those actions and those policies that can and will do harm. So we can't, you know, deny or hide away from the challenge of our time. But at the same time, if we give in to distress and fear, if we give in to the kind of adversarial consciousness that pushes others away as our enemies, we paradoxically diminish our capacity for Gaia-neering. We diminish our ability to weave and sustain and support the interconnections that are truly part of the Gaian life. This is the challenge each of us is going to need to meet. How can I be a clear and honest citizen of my nation, of my world, of my city, of my own heart and mind, and stand for what I believe and for what I know is right to serve Gaia, while at the same time building within myself the Gaian consciousness? This is where the different levels of Gaia can come into competition. Because at one level I say, wow, the self-regulatory processes that are the biospheric organism that Lovelock and Margulis pointed to in the Gaia hypothesis, these are in jeopardy. And human activity is having an impact. We need to do something about that. And there are in the world people who don't care, or seem not to care, or are in a position in life where they are unable to care because survival needs at multiple levels, emotional, mental, and physical, are more pressing to their separateness and to their ongoingness than the needs of a larger whole that may simply be abstract and not at all real in their everyday experience. And at the same time, one of the other Gaias, the thinking like a planet, the unfolding of a Gaian consciousness, even the partnering with Gaia, can become disconnected from us when the need to focus on the damage to the biosphere raises in us the anger and fear and distress that further separates us from each other. This is not an easy challenge by any means, and I don't want in any way to suggest it is. But it is the challenge of our time. It is the challenge of Gaia in our time. to be a life giver and a life sustainer and a life enabler without further aggravating the forces of incoherency, disintegration, disconnection, and separation that are already part of our human heritage, part of our habits and our history, and certainly part of our present. None of us can step away from this challenge because it's what's all around us. So at a simple level, at an everyday level, I need to monitor my heart and my mind. I need to say, how can I be a Gaian presence today in the face of anti-Gaian activity? What can I do to build the connections with others that will allow those projects that serve the wholeness of our world, the wholeness of our neighborhoods, the wholeness of each other to move forward? Hate moves in our world. And the media is not helpful in this regard because it's still operating at a level that says drama is important. So let's do what we can to make sure the sides of the conflict are always highlighted and drama is served. So who's for Trump and who's against Trump and how is this going to work out and who's fighting whom? And in the midst of the conflict, our potentials of alliance and alignment and embodiment of Gaia become lost. The conference that is coming up in July is a step that the Laurian Association is taking towards further and deeper exploration and contribution to this, to meeting this challenge. It won't have all the answers by any means, but it is a step and it will have some answers. And it's my pledge and Laurian's pledge to continue in the ongoing years and the years ahead to be a voice for hope, for joy, and for the Gaian presence, and to continually find ways that can serve each of us in meeting this unique and powerful challenge. What is hopeful about this is that none of us would be here, I believe, as souls in embodiment if we were did not have within ourselves the capacity to rise to this challenge, to meet the presence of Gaia in the deep interiority of our being, and to summon forth the powers of healing and of love and of transformation that are so urgently required. You are listening to me, I am sure, not because of anything I especially have to offer, but because of something in you that recognizes this is my community. I am here as part of this Gaian life. And whatever helps me remember this and stimulates its presence within me, I want to take part in. But where I really take part in this life is in my everyday world, in meeting the world that is around me and bringing to it the possibilities of love and joy and hope and resonance with Gaian presence. Thank you very much for participating in this talk with me today. I think actually I will leave it there. I said that there might be a possibility of answering some questions, but honestly, I would like us to go out from this talk together with a sense of the hope and promise that we carry as incarnate beings, as human fellows, as men and women at this time, and to just take time in silence or however we wish to feel the resonance, not with a sick Gaia, not with a dying Gaia, not with a Gaia in turmoil, but with a Gaia that is deeply flexing its presence and calling its human partners to it to make a genuine and lasting difference in the world at this time. Thank you all very much, and many, many blessings.